Bismillah, alhamdulillah, salat salam ala rasulullah ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. All praise be to Allah and blessings and peace be on the messenger and his household and companions. Well, today we have, I think there is no way that we don't talk about Gaza today, or Gaza. And we as Muslims must feel that we are one body. We must feel that we are parts of the one body. And when the body aches, part of the body aches, the whole body aches. When part of the body is in pain, the whole body is in pain. You don't go to sleep and leave your wounded finger awake, right? If your wounded finger is in pain, you will be awake. All of your body will be awake. Not like you'll go to sleep and leave that finger awake alone. And when you have a fever, when you have a little wound in your finger and you develop an infection in that wound, your whole body will be feverish. And that's exactly what the Prophet ﷺ used as a parable. He said the likeness of the believers in their compassion for one another, their mercy for one another, and their sympathy for one another is like one body. If one part of it, one organ, one part of it suffers, the rest of the body sympathizes with insomnia and fever. But, you know, I'm not going to talk about the issue of Gaza from that perspective, but I will talk about it from a different perspective, because I did address the issue of Gaza in some detail before. But I read a post on Minnesota Muslims, the web group, Minnesota Muslims, that said, why only Palestine? Why only Palestine? And the post cites some discrimination between the cases of African Muslims or the issues or the suffering of African Muslims and the suffering of Arab Muslims. And it's a very legitimate question to ask, by the way. And a very, very, you know, I'm not offended at all by the question that was asked. And I completely understand the viewpoint of the sister. The sister said that she converted to Islam 5 years ago. Yes, you hear a lot about Palestine when relatively smaller number of people have died than in many other conflicts in many other places. You hear a lot more about Palestine than you hear about other conflicts in other places that involve Muslims as well. So it is a very legitimate question, particularly if you not only if you converted to Islam recently, but also if you grew up here in America, because you were not raised on that sentiment of pain and suffering because of Palestine, which is not only limited to the Arab world, but it is all over the Muslim world. So if you grew up in the Muslim world, you will be able to sort of feel the issue, not just know it, not just understand it. You'll be able to feel the issue because it is all around you. It's all around you. But then again, why only Palestine? And why are we not talking about the suffering of Muslims elsewhere? And is this the only bleeding wound? No, it's not. Do we have bleeding wounds elsewhere in the body of this ummah? Yes, we do. We have a bleeding wound in Chechnya, and we had a bleeding wound in Bosnia. We had a bleeding wound in, you know, certainly in Bosnia and Kosovo. The issue may be somewhat different because we don't have a complete closure, I guess, to the issue. But we did have bleeding wounds in these places, and we had a bleeding wound in Afghanistan, which continues to bleed. We have a bleeding wound in Kashmir. We have a bleeding wound in Iraq. We have a bleeding wound in Somalia. We have a bleeding wound in Ogaden, which is a part of Ethiopia that is predominantly Muslim, that is subjected to enormous injustice. they are deprived of education, clean water, sewage. They're deprived of. This is one of the greatest turmoils that humanity can go through. Ogaden under the Ethiopian rule is suffering greatly. So we have a lot of bleeding wounds. So why most of the talk is about Palestine? And is it true that Arab issues because the sister sensed that the Arabs are being favored in the Masajid and that the Arab issues are being given more attention than the issues of the African Muslims? There are many issues that need to be addressed here. One is, could some Arabs be biased? Absolutely, yes. Well, biases and partisanship is a human disease. It's a human disease. Islam came to cure us from the human diseases. But did we all respond to the message of Islam like Abu Bakr and Umar? Did we all submit completely to the message of Islam? I did write this and I posted it, so apparently, hopefully one day you'll see it. We did not completely respond equally to the message of Islam. Doesn't Islam make the prayers the most mandatory, most required, most important act after Shahada? 50 years ago, 5% of Muslims prayed. I think conditions change nowadays. But 50 years ago, in certain countries, a very small percentage of Muslims were praying. And this is the most important, most vital, most essential, required act after saying La ilaha illallah. So not all Muslims responded to Islam equally, and not all Muslims submitted to the message of Islam totally. So could some Arabs have biases? Absolutely, certainly. Could some Arabs have no concern about any other issue but Palestine? Yes. Because for them, if you're not a good practicing Muslim, for them, for you, you will have to identify with some other, you will have to align yourself with some other identities, some other allegiances. So for you, the national issue will be the biggest on your mind. So yes, you could be rooting for Palestine because it is an Arab issue. And in this case, your sentiments will not be reward-worthy by Allah. You don't get rewarded by Allah because you have just these sentiments because you're Arab. You don't get rewarded. You get rewarded if you have the sentiment because you're Muslim and this is a Muslim case. So one is, yes, some Arabs can be biased. That's for sure. But I think that and being biased and partisan is a human ailment from which Islam cured many of us Muslims, but not completely and not equally. But in general, despite the fact that some of us could be nationalistic, could be tribalistic, could have different biases, could be racist, could be anything, could have different biases, despite the fact that some of us Muslims could have different biases, in general, as a community, as a religious group or religious community, in general, I think that we fared in this area much better than all other communities. I think that Islam did help us recover to a great extent, helped some of us completely recover, helped some of us recover to a great extent from biases, from nationalistic, racial, and other biases. A phenomenon like the KKK, for instance, a phenomenon like the neo-Nazis. Have you ever seen anything like this in the Muslim land, where people were being killed because they are of different ethnicity or race? You have to keep in mind, conflict between populations is one thing, and to enjoy killing kids because they belong to a different race is a completely different thing. When two different ethnic groups like the Kurds and the Arabs fight against each other in some place, or the Kurds and the Turks fighting each other over the Kurdish independence, they want to have their own state, and they kill one another that is a different story from killing just because they are different, and from targeting children or targeting people in a church or so on and so forth just because you hate them so much because they belong to a different ethnicity or a different race. Such phenomenon did not exist in the Muslim land. So, in general, we fared better. As individuals, we are subject to all human ailments and diseases. Some of us have responded to the message of Islam completely. Some did not. Some are better than others. In every aspect, not just this aspect, in every aspect. Some people pray and miss. Some people pray all the prayers. Some people pray their sunan. Some people do the night prayers. Some people love to pray. They miss the prayer. And they have the urge to pray because they want to pray. They want to converse with Allah. Some people do it with some difficulty, and so on. So we're very different. And in this regard also, we are very different. As for the favoring of Arabs over Africans in the masajid, if people are really impartial about this issue, they'll find out that it is a favoring of a language, not a people. Because those Arabs are dark, as the Sudanese and the people from Mauritania, and as light as the people from Syria, for instance, and Lebanon, and so on. And there is no favoring for the Arabs that are lighter. There is no Arab, you know, that is, you know, if you talk about Sheikh Muhammad al-Hassan al-Shanqiti or Sheikh Muhammad al-Amin al-Shanqiti before, you know, well, there is a difference. Certainly, Muhammad al-Amin al-Shanqiti was one of, you know, the best three or four or five in his time. It is not a matter of ethnicity. It is not a racial issue. It's a matter of perfecting the language that was spoken by the Prophet in which the revelation was transmitted to us. If there is a population, existing population nowadays, that speak Aramaic, which is the language of Jesus, peace be upon him, which is extinct, that population would have been, they would have been all over the place giving lectures about, you know, Aramaic, no, and this is what it is, and this is what it meant, and this is this, and this is that. The rabbis, the Hebrew, the Jewish rabbis, are the ones who master Hebrew, like the ones who do not master Hebrew. No, they are not. Even in the Catholic Church, are the people who master Latin, like the people who do not master Latin. Even though Latin was not spoken by Jesus, was not spoken, but it because the earlier manuscripts happen to be in Latin. So when this takes place, it is a matter of a language, not a race, not an ethnicity. And it is known that Arabs are the ones who spoke Arabic, are the ones who speak Arabic. So that's this issue. That just needs to be clarified from that aspect. And again, I confirm that many Arabs could be nationalists, could be racist, could be evil, could be murderers, could be hypocrites. They may not be praying. They may, but all of that is present. But in general, this is how Islam helped us move in the right direction. This is how Islam helped us move in the right direction. You have to understand that the Egyptians are not ethnic Arabs. You have to understand that Sayyidina Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam is not original Arab. Right? Because the Arabs are different types. There is al-Arab, al-Ba'idah, wal-Ariba, wal-Musta'ariba. Al-Arab al-Ba'idah, the ancient Arabs that are extinct. Al-Arab al-Ariba, the true original Arabs, genuine Arabs. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam is not one of them. He is from al-Arab al-Musta'ariba, the Arabs who were Arabicized. He's Arabicized. Not genuinely ethnically Arab. He's the greatest of all Arabs, for sure, and of all humanity, for sure. But what I'm trying to say here is that Ibrahim, his grandfather, was not an Arab. Ismail, his grandfather, was not an Arab. He is the son of Ibrahim. He grew up amongst the Arabs. He got married into the Arabs. And from him came the descendants of Ismail, which is Quraysh, part of this ancestry. These are not called the genuine original Arabs, which is Arab al-Ariba, these are called the Arab al-Musta'riba, the Arabicized Arabs, the people who became Arabs. Egyptians are not ethnic Arabs. You know, the people in North Africa, they are not ethnic Arabs. They became Arabicized. The Palestinians are not all ethnic Arabs. Some of them could be the Yemenis who immigrated from Yemen during the flood of Yemen, when the dam of Ma'rib broke and, you know, country was flooded and some emigrated. Some of them could come from this lineage. But the majority of them are not really ethnically Arabs, nor the Syrians and the Lebanese and so on. There were the Phoenicians, there were the Hittites, there were the Jebusites, there were the Canaanites, there were the Philistines. The word Philistine itself, many of the historians say that these people came from the Mediterranean, from the islands in the Mediterranean and Greece. Greece and Crete and Cyprus and those islands in the Mediterranean. And then they mixed with Arabs. East Africa, you can't say that the Somalis are Africans completely. You can't say they're Arabs completely. It's just a mixture. Because that was the model that was followed by the Sahaba, radhiyallahu anhum. This is how they got into those nations. Not by suppressing them, but by infiltrating them. How do you infiltrate them? You get married. And then you live with them, you get married, your kids will look like a little bit more like them, and then your grandkids will look a little more and more and more and more. You know, how many families in Pakistan claim to be Ashraf, claim to be from the descendants of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam? Do you recognize any difference in how they look? No, they don't. You know, they look Pakistanis after all. Because it gets diluted. You know, you get married and married and because genes, you know, get the genes from the other side, gets diluted. So that was the model that the Sahaba followed. So it became a matter of mixture. Mixed blood. So no one, you know, except some of the tribes, I'm telling you, the Prophet himself was not of the genuine origin of one, because he is from the descendants of Abraham, Arabicized. So that has to be understood, that being Arab is not a race, it is a culture and a language. The people who acquire the culture and the language become Arab, and that's it. So that is important to underscore. When they're favored in the masajid, that is the same way someone who speaks Hebrew will be favored in a temple, in a synagogue, or someone who speaks Latin will be favored in the Catholic Church, because people think that they do have a better access to the revelation. Sometimes by mistakenly, because sometimes people, you know, think that any Arab knows a lot and so on, and some of the Arabs, they know nothing. And people still ask them questions, and they misguide them. But, you know, that's just part of it. And this is important to say. What is also important to say here is that our bleeding wounds, if you're only concerned about Palestine, and this is how the question was phrased, and I completely understand the legitimacy of the question for someone who grew up here or someone who converted. When you say, why only Palestine? Yes, if people are only concerned about Palestine and they don't care about the Muslim issues elsewhere, that's because of nationalistic tendencies. That is not reward worthy. That is not praiseworthy. Some Arabs do, not the majority of them. Some do, and they're wrong, completely wrong. But you have to remember that when Afghanistan was in hardship and cried for help, tens of thousands of Muslims, Arabs and non-Arabs, poured into the country to die for the cause of Allah in this country. When Bosnia did, the same happened. When Chechnya did, the same happened. So it is not just a matter of why only, it's not why only Palestine, but why mainly Palestine? I guess that's how I would like to answer it. Why mainly Palestine? And why mainly Palestine has to do with many things. One of them is the sacredness of the land. This is not trivial. We do know that the blood of a Muslim is more sacred. Abdullah ibn Umar said to Al-Ka'ba, I know that the blood of the Muslim is more sacred than you. So the blood of the Muslim is very sacred to us. But you have to understand the difference when you attack the symbols of my religion. It's not just a matter of land. You're attacking my religion. Palestine is the land that was described in the Quran as the blessed land in Surah Al-Isra. Palestine is the destination of the Prophet's night journey, Al-Isra. Palestine is the beginning of the Prophet's ascent to the heavens. Palestine is the place of the third most sacred mosque to us Muslims, which is Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa. Palestine has our first Qibla. We used to first pray towards the Masjid Al-Aqsa before we prayed towards Al-Kaaba. The amount of ahadith that talk about Palestine, talk about conflict in Palestine, talk about, you know, joining the people of Sham during the end of time and the time of conflict and so on and so forth, makes this issue an Islamic issue of the first degree. You know, this is an Islamic issue. There is so much here that is different from other places. I am from Alexandria, Egypt. If I hear that the bomb fell on Alexandria, Egypt, I would be outraged, right? That some enemy dropped a bomb on Alexandria. I'll be outraged. And I will be extremely concerned about my family and friends, right? Yes. But you put yourself in my shoes also, and you can try to think about this. What if you heard that this bomb fell on Mecca or the Medina, or the Masjid of the Prophet in Medina? Is it the same? To me, it's not the same. It's absolutely not the same. It is a lot worse if it fell on Medina or Mecca than if it fell on Alexandria, Egypt. Not because I don't care about Alexandria, Egypt, but because you are attacking the symbols of my religion. You are attacking the heart of my religion. Not that Islam is iconical or, you know, believes in symbols and rituals, but this is quite obvious. These are my sacred places. This is the first mosque that was built for the worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and so on and so forth. So that is the first reason why mainly Palestine. One. The second reason why mainly Palestine is the magnitude of the crime. The magnitude of the crime. The magnitude of the crime makes any other crime pale in the 20th century. You have to understand that in 1880, there was no accurate census in 1880, but what we have is that the Jews were about 30,000 people in Palestine in 1880. Palestinians were about 600,000 people in 1880. Now, the Jews decided to have a homeland in Palestine. The Zionist movement decided that we will have a homeland in Palestine. You fast forward to 1922. That's when Britain conducted a census in Palestine, and they found that the Jews are 84,000 and the Palestinians are 670,000. 84,000, 670,000. You fast forward to the partition plan, and 1947, Declaration of Israel, the partition, everything, the Jews were how many? 600,000. Palestinians were 1.3 million. So, and that is not 2,000 years ago. We're talking about 1947. We're talking about just 6 years ago, or a little bit more than 6 years ago. What happened in this period is that, you know, many things happened, and we're not going to talk about the whole history because it will, you know, waste the time. Not waste, because it will not be wasted, but I want to talk about other issues today. But the issue here is that during this period, the Jews decided to immigrate to Palestine and to take that land because they can, you know, figure that it has no people, land without people, for people without land, which is the greatest and biggest lie. Because even archaeologically, there is a lot of evidence that this was the first settled population on Earth, before Egypt and before Babylon and before every other settled population on Earth. Forget about this. Don't worry about archaeology, and don't worry about these historical data, because they could be somewhat inaccurate. After all, who knows? But when Ibrahim came to this land, alayhi salam, the Old Testament tells us that there were lots of people there, right? It was never a vacuum. It was never void of people. There were the Philistines, the Hittites, Canaanites, Jebusites. Who built Jerusalem? The Jebusites. Not King David, not Dawood, alayhi salam. The Jebusites. So this was never a vacuum. Never. It was never a vacuum. So the very thought of a people without a land without people for a people without land is criminal. It is a huge crime. It is denying, stripping people of their identity. It is lying about a population, trying to erase a population off the map. The maps up until 1947, the old said Palestine, if you buy any old Bible, it may have a map in the back. It has nothing that it's Palestine. If you buy all of the old maps, Palestine under British mandate, like another nice name for British occupation. So Palestine under British mandate. In 1917, Balfour, which was a British prime minister, decided, you know, that the Jews have been suffering in Europe for too long. Let's give them a homeland where they can settle. So they're suffering in Europe. They're not suffering in the Muslim land. When Ferdinand and Elizabeth captured Spain, they didn't recapture Spain, by the way. The Visigoths are the ones who were in control of Spain when the Muslims took over. These are like Vandals. These are like the barbarians from the north. These were not the genuine original people of Spain, just for the record. These were like the Vandals who occupied Italy and so on and so forth. The geopolitical map of the world was changing, like, you know, in the speed of light, shrinking, expanding, shrinking, expanding. If you take the geopolitical map of the world to 1,000 years ago, you'll be amazed. Completely different picture, completely different map. So when Ferdinand and Elizabeth took over Spain, the Jews decided to flee to Morocco and Turkey, another Muslim country. Jews decided to flee from Europe. There is injustice there. There is inquisition there, to the Muslim land where there is justice. So the issue here is they suffered in Europe. So Balfour decided, well, they're suffering in Europe. And instead of giving them a piece of Europe, he gave them what he considered to be his own property, or the property of the crown. As if, you know, nations and countries can be owned by those individuals, and then they give them away. You know, we'll give you this. And then the rates of immigration escalated. And then with World War II, escalated more and more and more. You're being persecuted by the Nazis. And then everybody started to sympathize and say, no, they've been tortured enough. Let us give them a piece of land. We are not, we're against the Nazi conduct and behavior. We're against the Holocaust. We think it's horrendous. We think it's criminal. We think it's, you know, shame on humanity to have tolerated such atrocities. Yet, when Germany commits such atrocities, why do I have to pay the bills? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Why don't you give them what is it called, Bavaria? Or why don't you give them a piece of Germany? But it's just like, you know, you ride next to someone in the bus and they snatch your briefcase. And then you cry and cry and cry and they feel sad for you. And then they snatch a briefcase from someone else and give it to you. But they did not correct the mistake. Please, give me a break. You know, yes, the Germans were cruel, but then you don't take someone else's country and to make up those people for the atrocities committed by the Nazis. And now no one says German, by the way, it's always Nazi. Whenever it has to do with Muslims, it's Muslim. They try to emphasize every identity that we have. it's Arabs are doing this, Muslims are doing this. But whenever it's anything else, you know, it's the Nazis, it's the fascists. So it's not the Italians, it's the fascists. And it's not the Germans, it's the Nazis. Germans are all the people. Those are the Nazis who did that. But when it has to do with the Muslims, it's the Muslims and it's the Arabs, and they try to look for every synonym in the dictionary. But at any rate, so these are crimes. These are major crimes. In 1948, 420 villages, and these are the Western statistics, not ours, because we're not credible. But these are the Western statistics. 420 Palestinian villages were destroyed. 700,000 people were terrorized into exile. They were not driven out of their land, just like they just did not ask them to leave or send them cards, business, you know, some cards to invite them to leave, go to Syria, it's better there, the weather is nicer. No, they were terrorized out of this land by massacres like Deir Yassin, which was committed by the Irgun militia, which was headed by Menachem Begin, which later won the Nobel Peace Prize, by the way. So what Menachem Begin, who committed this atrocity against the civilians of Deir Yassin, that massacre against the civilians of Deir Yassin, he was born under the Russian rule. He went to the University of Warsaw to earn his degree in law. And then he and people like him claimed that they can now go to Palestine and take this land from its people and drive them out and say, we were here 2,500 years ago. We were here, okay? But if you want to reverse the hour this far back and change the, let's change the geopolitical map, such as like one of the British MPs said, you know, if we, the British, buy this argument, then we ought to give the whole eastern coast of Britain to Italy. Because if we reverse the hour, you know, 2,500 years ago, that is where the eastern coast of Britain is where the Roman Empire ended. So let us do this for all of us. He said it would be dangerous for us British to buy this argument. But if this is a valid argument, and you can really reverse the hour this far, well, it was not the Muslims, by the way. He says that, you know, the Jews were there, and Shimon prays. You know, he tries to act like he's like a big philosopher and thinker and so on, and tries to add a little bit of abstract meanings to his words so that people can envision him as someone who's like a great thinker. He said that it's an Islamic occupation of this land. Well, go back and study history. It was not the Muslims who drove you out of this land. You were not driven into the diaspora by the Muslims, by the Romans, who became Christian, and since they felt that you persecuted their prophet or God or son of God, whatever they believed at the time, they had different factions. But since our religious symbol and icon, that's when they persecuted you, and that's when you left. And then the Muslims took that land from the Romans, aided and supported by the indigenous population. Anyone who thinks that a few Arab tribes, Herodot even said, do not even bother going to Arabia. There is nothing there. You know, if you like to travel around, if you're a tourist, you like to travel around, don't bother going to Arabia. You'll find nothing. You can go to Alexandria, you can go to, you know, Babylon, you can go out west, to out east, this up north, down south, but don't bother going to Arabia. It was at these pretty much dispersed few numbers of people in tribes that were feuding tribes. If you think that those people can actually overpower nations from China to Andalusia, at that time, what they did was like in the speed of light compared to the time. They overpower all of this land and can control it. Keep in mind, Alexander the Great did something close to this. Not exactly like this. Not absolutely not like this. But even a little bit close. But by the time he was going back, he was killed and it was all gone. We're not talking about just conquering like this one way We're talking about conquering and staying. If you think that those few, and that's the Alexander, the so-called Alexander the Great, but if you think that those few little tribes, small tribes, can actually do this and control all of those countries, who are very sophisticated countries, very advanced countries in many ways, then this is just ultimate lack of sense. It was actually the people of those countries who aided the newcomers or the outcomers in moving forward. It was the people of Damascus when Abu Ubaidah decided to leave Damascus because the Romans were attacking it back, and he gave them the jizya and he said, I can't protect you anymore. It was the people of Damascus who decided, stay, we will fight with you. It was Bani Taghlib, the Arab Christians in Iraq, who said, we will fight with you. It was the Berbers, for instance, all over North Africa, who conquered Spain. Tariq ibn Ziyad is not Arab. Tariq ibn Ziyad is Berber. So it was the Berbers of North Africa who conquered Spain. That's why the Moorish, whenever they have pictures about the Moors, it's pictures of darker-skinned people. The Europeans usually... Moors is dark-skinned, by the way. That's where the name comes from. So it was the Berbers of North Africa that did this work. So the issue here is not, it was not the armies that were moving. It was the idea that was moving. It was the idea that people saw in it liberation, that people saw in it good, justice, liberation, that was moving. Moving by the people of the indigenous people of those lands forward, like the waves. It was the Egyptians who went and opened Libya. You know, Egypt was captured by the Sahaba. You know what the number of the army of Amr ibn al-As? 4,000 people. Can you imagine that a country like Egypt can be captured and subdued by 4,000 people? And then when he asked for more help, they sent him 1,000 more. It would be completely ridiculous to believe that a country like Egypt can be captured and controlled by 5,000 people. Would be completely ridiculous. So you have to keep this in mind. So this is a big lie. But if you reverse the hour, and we believe all of those lies, and you reverse the hour, when Abraham or Ibrahim alayhi salam, by the way, Abraham is a correct language. Abu Amr yaqra Ibrahim wala book. One of Abu Amr yaqra Ibrahim. Abu Amr, واحد منهم يقرأ إبراهيم. So Abraham is a correct language. Abraham or Ibrahim. Anyway, when Abraham or Ibrahim came to this land, he found the people, Canaanites, which were very much like the Arabs, the Jebusites, as I said, the Philistines, and so on and so forth. So why turn the hour to where you want, where you like, and not turn it a little bit back and say that before Abraham, these people were here. Abraham came from Babylon, and he was here transiently. You know, went to Philistine, and then went to Egypt, came back to Philistine, stayed with there. Isaac was born there. Jacob was born there. Yusuf and his brothers were born there. Yusuf was, you know, his brothers did what they did to him. He went to Egypt. Then he invited them over. Then they stayed over in Egypt from his time. Lived well in the beginning, and then the Pharaoh started to persecute them without mercy, for sure, in the end. And then Moses came, and he led them back to Sinai, and then Moses died in Sinai, and Joshua led them back into the Holy Land. And the book of Joshua in the Old Testament, for people who talk about violence, you know, just read the book of Joshua in the Old Testament. It would be helpful also to read the book of Deuteronomy and the book of Numbers. It's matchless. There is nothing, you know, there is nothing like this. You know, the burning of cities, the killing of children, the killing of the ox and the donkey, the killing of everything that can breathe, and so on. And the killing of the captives of war, according to them, Moses said that, all of them, even the children, except the young virgin females, they can keep for themselves. So, and then they talk about, you know, one verse in the Quran or two verses in the Quran that are completely taken out of context. Anyway, this is not the issue. But the issue here is they admit that when they came there, when they went there, and Ibrahim is the beginning. When they went there, the Philistines were there, and the people were there. It was never a vacuum. So that's the magnitude of the crime now. And then you fast forward a little bit. In 19, they decided when the Arabs, the partition plan, decided to give the Arabs 45% and the Jews 55%. Keep in mind, at that time, the Jews were 600,000 and the Arabs were 1.3 million. The Arabs felt, and many times, I get blamed for this so often. When I talk to people who are politicians or not politicians, I get blamed for this so often. Because people keep on saying, you know, you waste the chance, opportunity after opportunity, and chance after chance. You are going to get 55%, 45%. And look, you're trying to get 23% now. So it is your idiocy that, basically, they don't say that, but that's what they try and say. It's your idiocy that made you lose big. But again, you know, that's what I tell them. Put yourself in my shoes. You're sitting next to me in the bus. I have a briefcase. You take the briefcase. And then you tell me I will give you half of it. Well, initially, I will be quite upset. I want my entire briefcase. And then after a little time, you know, I'm upset. I get a little bit weakened by my depression and distress, get emaciated and so on. And then I try to fight for the briefcase. I may poke you, I may pinch you, stuff. You know, my briefcase. And then you said, no, well it's over. You know, the reality on the ground, George Bush recently said, the reality on the ground has to be considered, which means don't even be hopeful that you can get the 23%. It's the reality on the ground. What is the reality on the ground? The reality on the ground is that Israel can occupy the land, and then they insert a settlement way inside the West Bank, for instance. And in order for us to insert this settlement, we'll have to make a road to connect it to the mainland of Israel. And then because those Palestinians are cruel people and they're going to be attacking the settlers, you know, who came and took their land and so on. So they're too cruel. They're going to come and attack those settlers. Therefore, we must prevent them from coming near the road. Therefore, if the road goes through a village or so on, they can't cross from one side to one side. It tears the land, you know, apart. People cannot move from their house to their farm, from not to the village next to the next village, from their house to their farm, because now they decided to have this road that leads to this settlement and invite, you know, a couple of thousand Jews from Russia to stay there. And the people who have been there for 10,000 years now can't move from their house to their farm. And if they protest, they get severely punished. Even when foreign people... there was like an American lady or American young woman by the name of Rachel who was killed by like an Israeli. I think they ran her over or they shot her down. And she was Christian. She was white American. She did not look anything Palestinian at all. But, you know, there is no mercy for anyone who tries to stop them. So if we keep on talking about the magnitude of the crime, we're not going to finish. But this is the magnitude of the crime. It's about erasing a nation off the map, stealing my identity. You see, it would be a crime if you steal my coat, but if you say that you do not exist, that, you know, Hatem al-Hajj is actually someone else. Mashhood is Hatem al-Hajj, and you don't exist. So I go to my hospital, you're not Hatem al-Hajj. I go to my home, you're not Hatem al-Hajj. You know, because you... So my identity. There's nothing that is worse than this. There's nothing that's more criminal than this. Okay, the magnitude of the crime. Now, this is not the only bleeding wound, because we have a lot of bleeding wounds. But compare this to Somalia. Compare this to Somalia. I've been always very, very vocal against, you know, the Ethiopian intervention in Somalia. And as I said in the article, I'm paying some price for that. But compare this to Somalia. Do we think that Ethiopia really would be able to change the population of Somalia? No. It will never be. They may have some gains. They may have some gains, temporary gains. But Ethiopia is Ethiopia capable? Ethiopia has a lot of Muslims already, you know, in Ogaden and in the eastern provinces of Ethiopia. It would be impossible for Ethiopia to change the population of Somalia, to replace them and bring, you know, some other population in Somalia. So the issue here is we're upset and we're aggravated and we're very sad. Yes, but we're not that anxious because this is not a matter of replacement. We know that Ethiopia will leave Somalia at one point. Ethiopia will leave Somalia. Before Ethiopia, the suffering of our people in Somalia cannot be ignored. But then again, when it is an internal strife between us Muslims, it is different. If your two brothers at home are fighting against each other, is this exactly like someone else from the street coming, breaking into your home and beating your brother? Are your feelings going to be the same? No. You will condemn injustice, whether it is you, two of your own brothers at home are fighting against each other, you will condemn injustice. If someone from outside broke into your home and beat your brother, you will still condemn injustice, but your feelings are going to be different. And that's what it is for us Muslims. When it is an internal strife between different Somali factions, or internal strife between different Iraqi factions, or internal strife between different whatever factions, it does not aggravate us as when it is someone coming from outside, breaking into our home, and beating our brother. A different story. Now the issue of, because some people say Arab and non-Arab and this and that. Well, first of all, Somalia is not completely African. You know, but I didn't answer this. I didn't say to the sister in my answer that Somalia is not African. Somalia is a member of the Arab League. And the Somalis cannot be said, you know, they are African. I am African. I'm Egyptian. It's a mix. It's a mix. It's mixed blood. Mixed blood. Are we completely Arabs? I told you the Prophet ﷺ himself is Arabicized. So, but if it is an Arab and non-Arab issue, there is another country, a huge Arab country, that's under occupation now. It's called Iraq. This is the land of the Khilafah, the land of Baghdad. Do you hear about Iraq as much as you hear about Palestine? No. Why? They're both Arab countries. It's a different story. Different story because of the sacredness that we talked about before, and a different story because Iraq is not being replaced by another country. Ceuta and Melilla, Septa and Melilla. Two Moroccan cities that are under Spanish occupation. You need to be blind to not recognize that these are Moroccan, because the Mediterranean separates Spain in the north and Morocco in the south. These cities are in the mainland of Morocco, south of the Mediterranean. So you need to be really blind not to see that these are, you know, the population is Moroccan. The population speaks Arabic. The population is Muslim. It is south of the Mediterranean. It is within the Moroccan mainland. But Spain keeps in control of these two cities. Completely ridiculous. And do you hear about Ceuta and Melilla? Many of you may have not heard about the cities in the first place. These are two Arab cities under occupation. The Moroccans who go out to protest the Israeli atrocities against the Gazans and the rest of the Palestinians, nowadays, in large demonstrations, huge numbers, they do not show half of the zeal against Spain that's occupying part of their own land. I tell you with complete honesty, Sinai is three times the size of Palestine, and it's an Egyptian land. It's three times the size of Palestine. For the majority of the Egyptian people, not the Egyptian government, because the Egyptian government is a completely different story, but the majority of the Egyptian people, the issue was never Sinai. The issue is Palestine. Sinai is a peripheral issue. It is an issue, but it is a peripheral issue. The issue was Palestine and continues to be Palestine. It was never Sinai. Because of all of these differences that we talked about, I'm trying to underscore, it is not a bias that is unfounded. These are the reasons why, mainly, Palestine. So he said the sacredness and the many sacredness that we talked about now, and we said the amount, the magnitude of the crime. You add to this also, you add to the magnitude of the crime, the nature of the enemy. The nature of the enemy makes it more challenging. Therefore, it is more frustrating. Because the nature of the enemy is not too big, but the enemy is backed and supported by superpowers, has been throughout the history, backed and supported by superpowers, and well-connected. And those superpowers never failed to condemn the victim and to acquit the victimizer. You know, Balfour promises the land. You know, even Jack Straw, the previous foreign minister in the State magazine, he admitted the shameful role. He said that Britain did things that we can't be proud of in that whole crime, as you took part in that crime. Because Britain was saying to the Arabs on one side, you can help us against the Germans, we'll give you your freedom and liberty. And out of the other side of their mouth, they were promising the Jews to take the land. And they did so much damage. You know, watch the movie Lawrence of Arabia, although I don't watch movies. But if you watch movies, this may be less evil than others. So they did so much harm. And they continue to have superpowers back in them. The United States of America had used so far more than 40 vetoes to block resolutions from the United Nations. Block. You know how frustrating that is every time the Muslims back home hear it? When they see the killing and the massacres and they hear that the United States used the veto to block it? Well, if this is really the will of the international community, then why are you using the veto? Well, you know, the five permanent members in the Security Council, they are not all Muslims. In fact, none of them is. That's China, Russia, Britain, France, and the United States of America. So if you're saying that we're too weird and we are trying to propose a resolution that's quite far-fetched, quite out of touch, that's fine, you can say that. But what about the British? What about the Russians? What about the French? What about the Chinese? If it is really out of touch, it will fail. They'll vote on it and it will fail. But the veto means that everybody is in agreement and you decided to block it. And that veto thing is quite democratic, isn't it? It's just crazy. It shows you one of the manifestations of the hypocrisy of the international community and the international system that is talked about. So this creates frustration. The other frustration that makes it so painful for us is our powerlessness, our impotence. You know, if you feel the people in Jordan, they can't do anything. The people in Egypt, they're frustrated. They're seeing everything happening, and they are kept by their governments because their governments have decided that we have to raise the white flag. But, you know, why don't you try to make some gains? Why don't you try to do anything? No, they have completely frustrated themselves to the enemy. And that creates a lot of frustration, and that frustration adds a different dimension to the pain and suffering of the people. So the enemy, whenever the United Nations, by the way, it's not like the Security Council will do anything. You know, these vetoes are to block the resolutions so that the Israelis do not feel bad, basically. Because you have to understand that the resolutions that come out of the General Assembly are quite meaningless. They may be morally meaningful. Resolution 194, for instance, the return, it's a General Assembly resolution. It's not a Security Council resolution. So it's quite meaningless. It's not legally binding. Then you go to the Security Council. Security Council, they have their own set of tricks in the Security Council as well. Any resolution that has anything to do against Israel comes out as a Chapter 6 resolution, not Chapter 7. Chapter 6 versus Chapter 7 makes a great difference, because that makes the resolution non-enforceable. Non-enforceable. Does not have means to enforce it. Chapter 7 is for the weaker country. You know, make a Chapter 7 against, you know, Iraq, Chapter 7 against Lebanon, stuff like that. But whenever it comes to Israel, despite the enormous injustice that is out there, whenever it comes out as Chapter 6. So this adds a different dimension to why mainly Palestine, type of enemy. The other dimension is the duration of the suffering. The duration of the suffering. The duration of the suffering has been too long. People were born in refugee camps and they are now 60 years old. These people are told that you can't go back to your home, which is 25 miles away if you're in South Lebanon, or maybe closer. You can't go back to your home because now your home has to be taken by a Russian Jew who has never seen this land, and his ancestors have never seen this land. Has to be taken by a Russian Jew. Do you understand how frustrating that is? Because they're living in miserable conditions. What people don't understand about Gaza is that 80% of the population in Gaza are refugees. They were terrorized out of their homes and crammed into this piece of land, which Isaac Rabin said, I wish it falls into the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. And then they live in miserable conditions that were described by international impartial monitors as worse than the case of the apartheid in South Africa. So it has been too long, and it has gotten too old, and these people have deprived of their rights for so long. Now, for the last 18 months, the besieging of Gaza and the embargo imposed on Gaza, you know, I heard this rude Israeli commentator on Jazeera say, well, they say Islam is the solution. Let Islam figure it out for them. You know, okay, but if that is true, if that's truly a reasoning, then why didn't Judaism figure it out for you for hundreds of years of persecution by the Pharaohs? The issue here is, leave me alone and let me figure it out. It is not just that you have, you know, pushed me and crammed me into this little box. You closed it from all directions, land, sea, and air. You closed it from all directions. And you expect to starve me to death and to deprive me from necessities of life, such as electricity and gas and food and so on and so forth. And then I have nothing to do except to peacefully protest. And these are the new rules that they're trying to set for us now. People whose lands are occupied, they have a lot of alternatives. You can go and protest in the streets of London, amongst other capitals, but quietly, so that you don't annoy, you know, the passers by, or you don't annoy you don't block the traffic, and so on and so forth. You have to stay on the sidewalk. Okay, but I have been in, my land has been taken, my family has been massacred, my house has been demolished, I am being starved to death. Well, we protested in the streets of London for too long. We did protest in the streets of London. Then you can also write letters to the United Nations. You have to be civil now. You know, this is the new world now. You have to be civil. Your land is occupied, your family has been massacred, rocket hit your home and demolished it, and so on and so forth, but you've got to be civil. Write a letter, complain to the United Nations. That letter will eventually make its way to the trash can before or after a comic, you know, meeting to discuss the issue. And maybe a resolution, maybe not, who knows, and that resolution will never, you know, they will just stay in the drawers of the United Nations forever. The United Nations itself, they cannot do anything. The school of the United Nations was bombed today by Israel, killing about 40 people. That's a United Nations school. Two schools. Yeah. The United Nations, the previous relief, the president of the United Nations relief resigned. They can't do anything. So this is the issue here. The issue is the duration. It has been too long. How much pressure can you put on a people and expect them to demonstrate peacefully and write letters to the United Nations if their family members have been killed and massacred, if their houses are being demolished? Where are the human rights here? You know, demolishing of houses, the destruction of human habitat. Where are the human rights in all of this? So, the duration. Not only the duration, because there is an added factor here that luck is ticking against us. Because every time, almost all the time, Israel is building settlements. Do you know what that means? It means that you're losing on consistent basis, losing land on consistent basis. Even if you were given anything, George Bush reminded us recently. He reminded us of lots of things, by the way. But one of the things that he reminded us of, that the realities on the ground have to be considered. He reminded us earlier that he's committed to a Jewish state in Israel. Do you know what this means? Do you know Qaddafi? He's a Libyan president. I don't like Qaddafi, by the way, at all. But at any rate. But he actually suggested something that could be wise. I told the Fox News reporter this today. He was quite impressed. He said, well, it does make perfect sense, even though he doesn't like Qaddafi either. You would expect Fox would not like Qaddafi. But he said that this is quite interesting. Qaddafi actually suggested that you make a country, one country, and call it Esratain. Esratain in Arabic. And you get everybody back home, you know. I think that this is to some extent smart. Because they're claiming that the Arabs are out there, or the Muslims are out there to throw the Jews in the sea. Which has never been the case in the history. The great tolerance, the Columbia history of the world talks about the great tolerance, how the Arabs tolerated the Jews in the Middle Ages, and medieval Spain was the golden era for the Jews. There is so much to say, but at any rate. So if you're really saying this, that the Arabs want to throw you in the sea, well, this is a proposition here. That all the Jews who are in Palestine now stay and bring the Palestinians who, the refugees, and bring only the official refugees, the formal refugees, the UN documented refugees. Bring the refugees back home. Keep all the Israelis and live in one country, coexist in one country. Isn't that their exhortation? Usually they exhort us about, you know, secularism, and you've got to be open-minded. All religions are the same. They're equal. No, don't be too fanatic. But if you're saying to me that you're committed to a Jewish state, well, you're demolishing all of them. So you're saying that those people cannot go back home because this state must continue to be Jewish. Where is your secularism here, Mr. President? What secularism are you talking about? Why do you have to be hypocritical? Why do you exhort people about one thing and say a completely different thing out of the other side of your mouth? So it's just complete hypocrisy. So the time is working against us. That adds another dimension to the frustration. Because you're losing consistently and constantly. That is why, you know, that's why Palestine gets all of this attention versus the Arab cities of Sabta and Melilla, versus the Arab country of Iraq, versus the Arab land of Sinai, versus Somalia, versus Kashmir. Kashmir. The cause of Kashmir is very dear to us. But you have to understand the following. There are 180 million Muslims in India. It makes it a little bit different here. The Indians are not coming from Mars. You know, the Hindus in India are, with the Muslims, the people of India. They're not coming from Mars. It's a matter of the geopolitical map in this area, where you draw the border. Where you draw the border. The case of Kashmir is completely just. We have complete certainty in our, in the justice of our cause, because India has persecuted the Kashmiris for too long. It's very hard to accept now the Indian rule over Kashmir. And the United Nations has given Kashmir the right of self-choice, and India refused. So in terms of international law, we have a solid case. Yet it is somewhat different from Palestine. There are even Muslim scholars up until this point who think that the subcontinent and Muslims should have stayed within the subcontinent. I may not agree with this. I may not agree. I think that Pakistan as a country and Bangladesh as a country, they added a huge impetus to the impetus or momentum to the Muslim countries. Yet they have their own thoughts. And they're scholars. They're Muslim scholars. They're not hypocritical. They have their own thoughts. They felt that the subcontinent as one piece would have been a superpower. And the Muslims within this superpower would have been a very significant majority that can never be ignored. You have to understand, if you put all the Muslims of Bangladesh and Pakistan next to their counterparts in India in one country, that's a lot of people. It's a minority that can never be ignored. They have a point. I don't agree with it, but they have. It makes the issue of Kashmir different from the issue of Palestine, despite the fact that we see the just cause in both cases, but it makes it somewhat different from the issue of Palestine. Having said that, I think that we have to we have got short-term plan and a long-term plan. Short-term plan varies depending on where you are. You have to be smart. You have to be prudent. You have to not get yourself into harm's way, because any irresponsible, hasty behavior will not be good for you, will not be good for your community here, will not be good for the cause of the living people in Palestine, will not be good for the legacy of the martyrs of Palestine. So you have to understand all of this and understand your limitations. So you can supplicate, because no one will be after you if you're praying at night and making dua for your brothers and sisters. But you can make qunut with every salah. You can supplicate every night. Can stay up a little late and pray until the whole issue is they're relieved from this suffering. You can fast, you can give charity as a means to Allah's pleasure to make your supplication more worthy. You can donate through legal channels, and there is IRF, Islamic Relief Foundation. There are other legitimate legal channels licensed within the United States and other Western countries, and you will never, harm will not touch you if it touched you after you had done your best and taken your precautions, then let it touch you. Because Islam is not about, sitting on your couch. There has got to be sacrifice after you have been wise and prudent and reasonable and responsible and sensible. And yet, after all of this, you got into harm's way because someone just had to practice, some tyranny and injustice on you, then let it be. Let it be. The Sahaba sacrificed, the Tabi'in sacrificed, the generations of Muslims sacrificed, generation after generation. So donate, supplicate, donate, and be an ambassador. Speak on the behalf of your brothers and sisters under fire, but you've got to be able to communicate an intelligible argument on their behalf. So you've got to know your facts. You've got to know how to talk to people. Lots of people ask, to talk to the news media. And this is a disaster, by the way, for us Muslims. If you are going to talk to the news media tomorrow and you don't spend your night, reading, if you don't know, well, just catch up. If you don't know, why are you talking? And if you don't know and you decided to talk, well, catch up. Go online, try to figure out something, try to speak some numbers, try to speak some facts, try to be precise. try to have a clean argument, because babbling, like mumbling, and it doesn't just do much for anyone. It doesn't do anything for anyone. Let's try to have a clean argument, precise, effective, potent. So you need to read a little bit about the issue. And that's all short term. For people in Jordan and Egypt, they've got to figure out something short term also that is more than this. They've got to figure out something with their country. People in Egypt have to figure out why Egypt is aiding the demise of this nation that's part of our body, you know, by enforcing the embargo. And the president of Egypt keeps on telling us it's not possible because this is an occupying country. And under the international law, the occupying country under the international law has rights to make, to see and monitor everything that goes in and out of the occupied territories. What sense is there in this statement? Occupation in the first place is illegal. Embargo in the second place is illegal. You know, to starve people, to besiege like a population, starve them to death is illegal. It is not only illegal, it's unethical. Even the Pope of Rome said it's barbaric, a barbaric way of punishment. It's barbaric to starve a nation. You know, like the what happened in Iraq before the last war. It is barbaric to starve a nation. So if you're saying that, you know, the occupation, which is illegal, gives them legal rights, then I don't know what sense there is. The occupation, which is illegal, puts responsibilities on the occupier. The occupier must make sure that the supplies reach the occupied territories, that, you know, there is safety, there is, you know, food administration, etc. There are responsibilities. The occupier does not have rights in the international law. And then, this is the feeble argument. The feeble argument of the Egyptian government, and, you know, it's the same Israeli argument, is that we have to make sure of what's going in, what's going to go inside, because God forbid they may have guns. Well, they're occupied. They have the right to self-defense. In the international law, they have the right to resistance and self-defense. So this, God forbid they may have guns, you as an Egyptian government should be actually wishing for them to get their hands on some guns to defend themselves. And instead of just waiting for their bombs to rain on them from the sky, to be able to at least repel some of the low-flying choppers, chase them away from bombing their homes, from bombing their land, from killing their children, to chase away some of the tanks. You should be trying to do this. It's not like you're actually preventing them from food out of fear that they may sneak some guns. Well, they're not going to sneak F-16s inside the cheese. Even if they sneak some rifles, it's all for self-defense. Who's going to go assault another country with some rifles and machine guns? They're not going to be sneaking F-16s and B-52s. No, the treaty does not oblige Egypt, no, to close the borders with Palestine. Israel claims to have left Gaza. The border between Gaza and Egypt is between Gaza and Egypt. If they open it from their side, which is not their side, it's our side, that line has nothing, no value whatsoever. Anyway, if in the international law, they open it from their side, we have every right to open it from our side. So the people in Egypt, they have a longer list for short-term work that they need to do, particularly with their government. I'm not saying that they're going to go overthrow the government now. I'm just saying to press, to push, to apply all kinds of pressure. The long-term plan, briefly, is that this wounded nation, this weak nation, this suffering nation deserves your effort. You need to have some devotion, some commitment to the cause. You need to learn about your deed. You need to practice your deed. You need to give dawah. You need to rectify your affairs, rectify the affairs of your family. You need to come with and be with the Muslims. If you don't come to the masajid, you can get, like, if you hear those news and you don't come to the masajid, you either get overwhelmed and you have a complete breakdown, or you become indifferent. And both are devastating ends. So come to the masajid and renew your commitment with Allah. Renew your commitment with Allah to help rescue this ummah, to help the awakening, the revival, the renaissance of this ummah of ours. There is no time to waste. And if we blame our grandfathers for things that they have done wrong, we're repeating them. And it doesn't make any sense to blame them and to repeat their same mistakes. So there has got to be a repentance, there has got to be an awakening individually, because it's our collective sin, without acquitting the victimizers of their crimes. But it happened to us. The victimizers were given power over us because of our own sin, our own departure from the religion. It will take a lot of effort. You have to understand that you should not have bad thoughts about Allah and His promise and His victory. Prophets and messengers and their followers suffered at the hands of tyrants throughout the history. The Israelis, when they were the chosen people, were persecuted by the pharaohs for generations. The Yahya ibn Zakariya, John, he was killed and his head was given away to a prostitute. So this does not make us question the destiny or the qadr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You have to understand that once the bodies of our martyrs fall to the ground, their souls ascend to the heavens. So, you feel for them, you're saddened because of the suffering of their families, but this is an ending that everyone should envy. Our people who, fell in, not in the battleground, who were basically massacred and eliminated by the violent war machine of Israel, and they are in the heavens. We believe that they are in the heavens, collectively, generally, as martyrs. They will be in the heavens. They are in a much better place than we are now. So don't let despair sneak into your heart. And have good thoughts about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and blame yourself. Blame yourself. Don't blame the ummah. The ummah is blameworthy, collectively, but blame yourself first. Because that is how we can make a change. Because if we keep on blaming Israel and blame this and blame that, and we do not blame ourselves, the first time I saw the news, I got so angry against myself. It is my failure. It is the failure of each and every one of us. It is the shortcoming of each and every one of us. It's the sin of each and every one of us that brought the ummah to this position, to this the position of humility and weakness. So I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make it easier for our brothers and sisters in Gaza. And I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to relieve their distress and to end their suffering and to end it completely and to give them victory over their enemies and to grant their shuhada the highest jannah, al-firdaws al-a'la, and to heal the wounds of the wounded and to give patience to the families of the dead and the wounded.